So it's been quite a few months now. We've been pretty steady about doing our Tuesday night class. I think the only time we missed was the Tuesday before Holy. Otherwise, Lisa and Wendy have been steady as a rock, and Jerry. Nice to have Lori with us also. And we just finished a series on the six Goswamis of Vrindavan, which took about 4 weeks. And this is not original material. This is compiled by the president of Pune Temple in Maharashtra named Radhi Shyam. And it's based on a book called Discover Yourself by himself, Radhi Shyam. And it's under the auspices of an organization called Voice, which, as you see here in the corner, is Vedic Oasis for Inspiration, Culture, and Education. Pune is like the it's like the Boston of India. There are like 120 colleges in Pune. And so the devotees have a very vigorous program in Pune of college outreach. And this is a part of a six-part series about how science and religion are not necessarily at odds. In fact, they complement each other. I'm not sure if we're going to get through this first part in the half an hour that we have before the yoga class starts, but we'll go as far as we can. And again, this isn't material that I've compiled. It's just so impressive and it's so simple that I feel like I can go through it with a fairly good amount of fluidity, nowhere near on the level of Radhi Shyam. But he's done it in such a way, such a compelling and such a logical way that I think I can do it without too much hemming and hawing and stuttering and stattering. So why we even ask this question or why we even think about God is because we're in the human form of life. Animals are inquisitive, but they don't inquire about God or the soul or where we're coming from. Animals are inquisitive about what to eat, where to sleep, with whom to mate, and how to defend their territory. That's the level or the extent of their inquisitiveness. But only in the human form of life can we go beyond physical concerns and think about what we call metaphysics. Physics are just survival business, and metaphysics are things which go beyond survival. They go to the level of transcendence. And I don't know if the animals are curious about the stars in the sky and about the solar system, but I know that I am, and I know that you are. And so it leads us to ask deeper and more meaningful questions. When Radhi Shyam does this seminar, he asks people, you know, what are the reasons that we have, what lends us towards a belief in a God? You know, what are some of the things that make us believe in a God? And some of the answers that he's been given in his seminar are, you know, the seasons change according to schedule, spring, fall, summer, winter. Who's behind that? Sun rises and sets. The fact that life is created in myriads and myriads of forms, and we can't do it. We can't do it in spite of the bombastic claims of our scientists. We can't create even the simplest life forms in the laboratory. We can create the conditions. We can put the chemicals there which are conducive for life to occur, but we can't actually originate or create life in the laboratory. And yet life has been created in millions and millions of forms and varieties since time immemorial. Prabhupada told a joke one time about the scientists trying to imitate God. He said one time a man came into a small town. He rented the town hall and he put up posters all over town that if you'll come on Saturday night and you pay $5 entrance fee, I will imitate all the farm animals. The crow, the barking of the dog, the mooing of the cow, the neighing of the horse, you know, the cock-a-doodle-dooing of the cock. And so people were actually foolish enough to pay $5 and go and hear the guy imitate what's, you know, just all, it's all around you. You know, it's all around you. And there are people who pay $5 to go and see someone imitate barking and crowing and neighing and mooing. So the scientists are like that. God has been creating life in millions and millions of forms seasonally since time immemorial. And then the scientists, they say, oh, we'll create life. But they can't even create one flower or one grain of rice or one fertilized chicken egg. And even if they did, what would be their credit? I mean, God has been doing it effortlessly since time immemorial. But if they should theoretically be able to create one little bit of life, then they would want to be called God, and they wouldn't want everyone to bow down to them, and they would be the high priests of a new reductionist atheistic religion. But they can't. They can't even create life. Also, another thing that leads us towards God is the fact that anytime we see organization, there's always a person behind that. We never see that where there's organization, it has happened by accident or by chance. Many of the scientists would have us believe that all the organization of the universe happened as a result of a big bang or an explosion. And yet when, as a result of an explosion, have you ever seen things go from a less orderly state to a more orderly state? If we were to explode this building, it would go from a highly orderly state to a highly disorganized state. So explosions don't tend towards higher levels of order. They destroy whatever order is there. And so it absolutely goes against common sense and experience to believe that this universe was created as a result of a big bang. Anytime we see a design, we immediately ask who's created this. And the more complex the design, the more sure and certain we are that it's been designed by a creator. There's a story of Sir Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton was a scientist, and many of the greatest scientists, the lesser scientists, may call themselves atheists or disbelieve in God, but the greatest scientists have across the boards realized that their science leads them towards believing in an intelligent designer. And Isaac Newton was one of those scientists. Albert Einstein was another scientist. Isaac Newton says, "I do not know what may appear to the world, but to myself I seem to have been like a boy playing by the seashore and diverting myself in it now and then and finding a smoother pebble or a pretty shell than ordinary, whilst the great ocean of truth lay all undiscovered before me." So the knowledge, the ocean of truth about God is compared to the water. And Isaac Newton says, "I and my fellow scientists, we didn't even get into the water. We didn't even really get into the real, you know, stuff of knowledge. We were on the beach, you see, playing with the sand. And even then we only discovered, you know, one or two or three grains of sand." So all of our material knowledge, our material education, our material discoveries is just like picking up a few grains of sand on the beach. And the beach is not the real water. The beach isn't even the real area, the real arena. See what I'm saying? It's like going to the airport. The airport may be a gateway to going to London and Paris, but going to the airport is not synonymous with going to London and Paris. And so Isaac Newton had a friend over one day, a very vocal atheistic friend. Isaac Newton invited him to his house. And Isaac Newton had caused to be constructed a model of our solar system in the house, suspended with, you know, fine filaments of thread, and sun was there, and the moon, and the mercury, and stars, and everything like that. And when his atheistic friend walked through the door, he marveled. He marveled at the design, at the accurate, true design of the, and it's just a model. It's just a little child's model of the universe taking up one room in Isaac Newton's house. And the friend said, "What a marvelous arrangement this is. Who made it?" That was the trap that Isaac Newton had set for him. He said, "Nobody made it. I just came home one day and there it was." And his atheistic friend said, No, I don't believe you. You know, this couldn't have happened by accident. This is a wonderful model with spinning orbs and different things that are colored and everything in the right position. Somebody must have made it." And Isaac Newton said, No, it just happened." And the guy said, "Something like this can't just happen." And Newton said, Okay, listen to yourself. Listen to what you're saying. This is a little model. It's just a duplicate. I mean, the universe is out there. And here's a little bit of information. The Earth, the mass of the Earth, is 6 times 10, I guess that's 60, metric tons. Its speed as it orbits the sun is 106,000 kilometers per hour. 106,000 kilometers per hour. That's, you know, it seems stable to us, but this Earth is moving at 106,000 kilometers per hour. But it's on its orbit. It moves on an orbit. It moves on an axis. And all the other planets in the solar system are moving at these tens of thousands, but they're also moving on an axis. And all the axes aren't the same. They're not all moving this way. There's different axes, and yet they never conflict. They never crash into each other. In fact, Pluto, the axis of Pluto, it actually, there's two planets going this way, and since time, Pluto, like, what is it called? Shoots the gap. Pluto shoots between two planets that are coming together, and they've never crashed. They've never crashed. So Isaac Newton said to his friend, this is just child's play. This is a child's model. And you insist that this could not have happened by accident. You insist that this had to have been created, that there had to have been a designer. And all it is a child's imitation of the actual universe. And when it comes to the universe, you say there's no God. It all happened by accident. What kind of logic or consistency is that? So then the friend said, well, you may have a point there. So we can't see God, at least not in our present state, because we're conditioned. And we have material eyes, we have material nose, we have material senses. So matter can only perceive matter. Matter can't perceive spirit. And so we have rarefied vision and rarefied senses, we'll not be able to see God. It's not to say that we can't see God. In fact, all the great saints and sages of India said that God can be seen, but we have to have eyes anointed with the salve of love. In the meantime, we can see God, we can infer God, we can deduct God, who's at present unseen, from what we can see. People say, well, if there's a God, let him show himself to me. Or, how can I believe in a God I can't see? But remember, God is not at your beck and call. God is God, he's the Lord, and we're the servants. So the Lord doesn't have to appear before at the snap of the servant's finger, neither does the Lord have to prove himself before the servant. It's rather the opposite, that before he can see the Lord, the servant has to prove himself worthy and humble and faithful to the Lord. So here it said here that although we may not have seen the personality of Godhead with our eyes directly, there are innumerable evidences to prove God's existence from the things that we see around us. You know, there's a whole science of electronic engineering. It's a whole science. And it's involves billions and billions of dollars of commerce. There are thousands and thousands of people who have got their master's and their PhD. And the whole thing, the whole science of electronic engineering is based on the electron, which nobody has ever seen. Nobody's ever seen it. And yet there's machines, there's models, there's commerce, there's people involved in working on this. It's an entire industry, one of the larger industries in the world, generating billions and billions, and no one has ever seen an electron. No one's ever seen one like that. In a cathode ray tube, you can see sort of the reflection of the electron. You can see the reflection of it, but actually you cannot see the electron itself. But you know it's there by inference, by inferential logic. Today, I didn't see the sun all day long. But how do I infer that the sun's out there? Because of light, because of sunlight. See, I infer the sun from the sunshine. I don't have to see the sun directly, but because there's sunshine, I know that the sun is out there. So I hate these little tricks here. I hate them because they throw you off your rhythm and all. That's why I don't have them in my own slideshows. They just seem ridiculous to me. In the following slides, you'll learn to see God based on your practical experience of things around you. And, of course, the universe is one of the things that surrounds us. So here are some unanswered questions that have to do with the origin of the universe. Who created the universe? That's a question. How does the universe originate? What is the purpose of this complicated universe? We see all kinds of wonderful creations around us. Here's a picture of a beautiful flower that exists. I believe it's in the ocean.
It's a blue lotus.
Blue lotus flower. This is a rose speckled with dots of morning dew. This next one, I love this one. Look at those. Aren't they cute? Aren't they cute?
They went to Hawaii.
Here's a multicolored fish there. There's a little baby polar bear.
That.
A couple of baby cats here. Like that. So, you know, if an artist like Cezanne or Van Gogh or something paints a sunflower, paints a little, you know, vase of posies on the table, you know, that painting can be auctioned off in the modern day for tens of millions of dollars. I believe there was a Cezanne painting that went for $30 million not too long ago. And all that is just a two-dimensional replication on oil and canvas of a flower. The flower itself had a third dimension. It had texture. It had aroma. It had more vivid colors, and it had lots of friends, too. It wasn't just a single flower on a two-dimensional piece of canvas. So people will credit an artist like Cezanne and Van Gogh with the artistry to produce something like that. But it never occurs to people, well, what about giving God a little credit, you know? What about all the beauty that we see around us that's created by God? What about His aesthetic sense? Because if everything was created mechanically as a result of an explosion or the random bumping of molecules, everything would just have turned out like it had come from an assembly line. There would be a certain set of circumstances which create life, and those circumstances would be fixed and set, and then the life they would create would be just knockoff life, like one after the other on an assembly line. And yet we don't see that. We see life in millions and millions of forms and varieties and color, and we see it so cute and coochie coochie coo and goodly goodly like that. You know, we can't keep our hands off the cat, you know, we can't stop making bird sounds with the birds. You know, it's just so engaging, it's so intriguing, it's so wonderful. It's impossible to believe that this resulted by accident. Take a banyan tree in the Calcutta Botanical Gardens. There's a banyan tree that takes up 3 acres. It takes up 3 acres in the Calcutta Botanical Gardens. Now, I don't know if you know about the banyan trees, but they don't have very big trunks. They spread out horizontally, and then the branches, some of the branches go down vertically. And so that's how it spreads and how it supports itself, and it grows and grows and grows and grows. So one of the largest banyan trees in the world is in the Calcutta Botanical Gardens. It's several hundred years old, and it started from a little seed. It started from a small little seed. And in that seed, the entire design of the future banyan tree was encapsulated. And that seed cannot be created by any scientist or any philosopher, any MIT graduate, any Nobel laureate, any PhD. They cannot create even a small seed with that design of life in it. And it's so small. Talk about micro design. You imagine that huge banyan tree, which today is 3 or 4 acres, 500 years ago, that design was contained within a tiny, tiny, tiny little seed. And we also, we were conceived in our mother's womb. Our mother and father got together, and we were conceived. And 3 days after their secretions, which were basically liquid mixed, there was a little tiny pea-like, you could hardly see it, a little pea-like substance that was formed. That was you, and that was me. With all of our DNA, all of our RNA, everything programmed, you know, if you're going to get, you know, if you're going to be athletic, if you're going to be good-looking, if you're going to have a good head for figures, if you've got a genetic disorder or a genetic order, if you've got a talent, it was all there. It was all programmed in that little tiny pea. And that pea began to grow for 9 months in the womb. Then it came out. And what happened during the ensuing lifetime is we basically fulfilled, or didn't. We either used or we misused. We either capitalized upon or we failed to capitalize upon all those advantages and talents which were pre-designed into that little pea-like substance. So these things don't happen by accident. And it's entirely valid and logical to ask who created the universe. Who designed it? You see Mona Lisa. You know, Mona Lisa is famous for that cryptic smile, you see. As soon as you see Mona Lisa, if you go to the Louvre and you see the... Who painted this? Who did that? Who painted that cryptic smile? Nobody would believe that it happened by accident. Here's a painting. You look at the painting, you appreciate it. What do you ask? What's the next thing you ask? Who painted it? And the answer is David Copenhagen. Here's another one, another painting. Well, you ask again, who painted it? Another landscape. I can't read it, I've got something in front here. What's it say? John Green. So it's naturally when we see the universe in all of its variety and all of its dimensions, who created it? Who designed it? One of the most amazing trees that exists on the planet is the sequoia trees in Northern California. Some of those trees are antennae. This antenna, I don't know if you can see it here. It's high. I tried to climb it one time with the safety belt and all, and honestly, I didn't get very far. I mean, just, it was scary, you know. We had a devotee, he liked to climb, so he went all the way up to the top. We said, what's it like? He said, it's scary. It sways, you know, that high. It sways. I mean, you're going like 6 feet this way, 6 feet that way, and you have to hold on. That tower is 180 feet high. There's sequoia trees that are twice as high as that tower. They're twice as high as that tower. And they're so thick around, it takes like more than 20 people holding hands just to encompass the girth of that sequoia tree. And some of those trees are 3,000 years old. 3,000 years ago, those trees, those 300-foot high, thick trees, were in the seed which could fit on the head of a pin. So who is the artist behind all of this? Let's look at space technology also. There are so many things that depend upon space technology and satellites. Our mobile phones, all the internet connections that we have, TVs now depend on satellite. There's so many TV channels. Now these satellites don't get up there by accident, and they don't stay there without attention. These satellites, which have become so integral to our lifestyle, were launched from Cape Canaveral. They were designed years and years before. There were trial and error. There were whole teams, whole legions of highly paid, highly skilled PhDs and engineers designing this thing, putting it into practice, then launching it out of space. And then once it's out there, to get the benefit of it, it's monitored 24/7. It's monitored by highly qualified people at ground control. There's all kinds of parameters that have to be constantly observed by highly paid human beings. And the reason they have to monitor it is even the smallest error can lead to big problems. We all remember when that space shuttle with the Indian astronaut, Kalpana Chawla, exploded. That was a little problem, a little gap between panels that wasn't welded together, and then that just got in a finger snap. It exploded the whole thing. So even the smallest problem, his promise, discrepant error, can lead to a huge, huge, huge. Now think of the Earth as a satellite. Think of the Earth as a satellite. It's going at thousands of kilometers an hour. It's keeping to its orbit around the sun, and it's not happening accidentally. So if those satellites are in the sky, and our little tiny satellites require so much attention, so much monitoring, and if even a little error can lead to a huge thing, then how can we believe that the satellites, which are working perfectly, which are perfectly designed, which never exploded with any astronauts inside them, which never ran into any other, satellite, and which give us real benefits? I mean, not just like mobile phones and texting and, you know, this Earth satellite gives us grains and it gives us sunshine, it gives us air to breathe, it gives us water, gives us material to build our houses, gives us so much more which are essential and practical and which make us happy. You know, the more we get involved in the satellite technology, the more we remove ourselves from basic sources of happiness. Having your own land, growing your own food, being with your own family members, you see, laughing and joking with them and harvesting and cooking and sitting down and enjoying a meal and seeing your children and your grandchildren work the same land that you have for generations and generations. Those are the benefits that this satellite, this Earth satellite, provides. So in every way, it is on a scale which is millions of times greater than the little Sputnik scale. And it gives benefits which are millions and millions of times more real and more satisfying than all the benefits of all the satellites. When the first Sputnik went up, I was a kid and I remember reading the newspapers. My father came home with the front page news. The Russians had beaten us. The Russians had beaten the Americans. They put the first satellite in the sky. And they put it to Prabhupada when Prabhupada came. What do you think? And Prabhupada said, man is created in the image of God. So God has creative powers and man also has creative powers. Because he gets creative powers from God, he puts his little Sputnik in the sky. But God's creative powers are so much bigger. He's so much more powerful than we are. That his Sputnik is Earth, Mars, Venus, Jupiter, and so on and so forth. And they work much less, more flawlessly than our own things. There's a verse in the Sanskrit that says, out of fear of God, out of fear of God, you don't need all kinds of guys, you know, monitoring on screens and everything. Why is everything working perfectly in the universe? Out of fear of God. Because it is God's will. It is God's remote control, wireless will that the sun comes up on time, sun goes down on time, the seasons change. You never have to fear that the sun will be late or the sun will disappear, because the sun is mounting its chariot and appearing on the eastern horizon and running its course and disappearing exactly according to God's schedule, out of fear of God. And also everyone is dying. Everyone is also dying out of fear of the Lord, because when our time comes, we cannot extend it even for a moment. So look at this complicated piece of equipment. And look at it against the background of the earth. See, here's the little satellite. Here's the big satellite. See, here's man's satellite, which is so defective. And here's God's satellite, which is so perfect. Here's the control room. Some of the details of satellite monitoring, round-the-clock critical observation of the critical parameters. And some of the parameters to monitor are the orientation of the satellite. The spin of the satellite has to be just right. If any of these are wrong, you have a major disaster, especially if it's manned. The velocity of the satellite. The orbit decay corrections. The orbit decay corrections. The Earth's satellite distance. The heat dissipation. The cosmic radiation. All these are parameters that have to be monitored. And yet, God's satellites are working perfectly just because He wills it to be so. Again, this is the mass of the earth. Oh, 6 by 10 to the 21th power. That was missing in the earlier graphic. That's how much the earth weighs. And its speed around the sun is 106,000 kilometers per hour. Here's the galaxy and the Milky Way. All those planets are in orbit and they do not crash into each other. We have a little freeway with just 2 lanes, wide lanes, sometimes 4 lanes. And they're manned by imperfect human beings, and they're always crashing. I mean, never a day goes by that you don't have, you know, fatalities and accidents. I was driving back from Provo Canyon. I don't know what I was doing up there. Oh, yeah, I had to go to the Hobie, the youth conference Thursday a week ago. Coming back, there were some cars parked on the side of the road. They'd rammed a bicyclist. I don't know how they did it, because like, it's wide. And they've got a whole bicycle lane, but some or other someone wasn't paying attention or went around a curve and just knocked a bicyclist. His whole bicycle was mangled and was lying on the ground, and so on and so forth. Yeah. So who is in control? Scientists are trying to develop supercomputers. There's a lot of brouhaha nowadays about supercomputers. And there are departments of artificial intelligence at MIT and other universities. But artificial intelligence is not a big deal. It's just borrowed intelligence. If you want to learn how to compute a certain function or a certain problem, you just collate all that's been done in the area, you put it into a program, you write a program for it, and there it does. It just mimics, it apes what knowledge is already available. But the most sophisticated supercomputer, you know, these supercomputers that the government has, they fill whole rooms and rooms and rooms, and they do all these calculations. But the most sophisticated supercomputer in the world is what? What do you think? The human brain, exactly. There is no computer that can match the number of operations the human brain can do, nor can it match the size of the computer itself. As soon as our yoga teacher comes here, as soon as Nitya arrives, we'll stop. But thanks for that heads up. Hanuman? Okay. Here is some information. The human brain can store more information than all the libraries in the world, according to a book called The Brain by Dr. Richard Restock. The human brain is made of 1 trillion brain cells, and each one is more powerful, not the brain, but each one of the 1 trillion cells in the brain is more powerful and sophisticated than most computers around the planet today. But who made the natural intelligence of this incredibly complex computer brain? Who made that? So I think that would be a good time, good place, a good juncture to stop, and we'll continue.